My name's Kaz, and I'll be facilitating today. We're in, this is session 1B, so you've chosen to come to this room. These sessions won't run again. And we'll be hearing from three speakers this morning. So we've got Darren McKenzie, who will be speaking on reducing emissions from planned burns. Beth Ebert, who will be speaking on smoke dispersal modelling. And Liz Hamilton, who will be speaking on an outline of agricultural stubble uses as alternative to burning in Victoria. So what we'll be hearing from each speaker for 10 minutes, and then we'll have time at the end for questions and answers. So as we go through, if you have any questions, just make a note of that on your book and save them for the end, because you will have the opportunity. There's quite a bit of time at the end for us to go through and have a bit of a panel discussion with some questions and answers. If you can't hear or if there's anything like that, just pop up your hand and so we can resolve those issues as we go. So firstly, we'll be hearing from Darren McKenzie, who's the Deputy Chief Fire Officer for the statewide integration at the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning. Darren has extensive experience in the forest and fire management in both private and public sectors. As the DCFO, Darren supports the Chief Fire Officer in determining preparedness requirements and ensuring the command, control and coordination arrangements are effectively implemented across the state. Darren also has the responsibility under the CFO in relation to fire and emergency readiness, response and planned burning operations. So I'd like to welcome Darren.
Thanks, Kaz. Thanks for that introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here today to talk to you about what is a very important issue for all Victorians, and that is clean air. I'll just get myself set up here. Today I thought I would really talk about step through the presentation in three key areas. So I want to talk about why planned burning, why do we undertake, what's the importance of planned burning. I want to talk a little bit about the smoke management frameworks that we operate in, both at a emergency management at a sector level, but also at a departmental level in terms of how we manage decision making around managing the risk of smoke on communities. And then I just want to briefly talk about some of the future challenges that we see in planned burning and how they impact on smoke management and the risk that that smoke might cause to communities. We understand and we certainly acknowledge the impacts of smoke on Victorian communities, and we understand that smoke can be a real issue, and in some cases, it's in the worst case, it can be a significant health issue to some individuals, particularly if they have some sort of pre-respiratory condition. So we're well aware of the impacts that smoke can have, and we're well aware of what our activities and impacts might be there. So just to start off with, really quickly, just wanted to touch on why planned burning, and probably most people in the room would understand that Victoria is one of the most fire-prone regions in the world, and we've all seen the devastating impacts of bushfire over the decades. Black Saturday 2009, there's that iconic picture there of the fire truck heading down the gravel road with the massive big smoke plume in the background. Paper clip there from Ash Wednesday, which was February 16th, 1983, when 47 Victorians lost their life and 28 people in South Australia lost their life. And up until Black Saturday, that was Australia's worst national disaster. The Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning has a legislative responsibility to prepare, prevent and respond to bushfire on all public land, and that accountability sits with the Secretary under Section 62(2) of the Forest Act. And in addition to that, there's further accountabilities and responsibilities outlined in the Code of Practice for Bushfire Management on Public Land. So those two documents are key documents in terms of what the legislative accountability of the Department and the Secretary is to manage the impacts of fire. And one of the key tools that we use to manage those impacts is treating fuel using planned burning and other mechanical treatments, because if we treat the fuel, it gives us a better chance to suppress and control and minimise the impact of bushfire. Over the years, we've seen a number of government inquiries into bushfire and the management of those fires. The vast majority of those inquiries have identified planned burning as one of the most effective risk mitigation tools that we can use to reduce the risk of bushfire and to minimise the impact on Victorian communities. The most recent of these was the Bushfire Royal Commission in 2009 into Black Saturday, and that commission made a recommendation that Victoria should treat 5% of all public land, which was about 390,000 hectares, and that if we were to do that, we would be able to keep bushfire risk at what was deemed an acceptable level at the time. In February 2015, the government asked IGEM, the Inspector General of Emergency Management, to review that performance metric, and IGEM made a recommendation to the government that we should move to a risk-based approach, and the new metric then adopted by government was to manage residual risk for bushfire at 70% across the state. So Victorian government policy now is to manage residual bushfire risk at or below 70% on a statewide basis. In terms of the size of the program, that means from a deep from a Forest Fire Management Victoria perspective, means that we're looking to treat around about between 200 and 250,000 hectares per annum, either through mechanical means or through the use of planned burning. So it's a fairly sizable program. Just in relation to smoke management framework, and this was the state management framework that was put in place following the Hazelwood mine fire in February 2014. And this was Victorian government's attempt to ensure that we had a coordinated sector-wide approach to the management of smoke and how we were going to minimise the impact of smoke on Victorian communities. This framework applies to all fire, so it includes bushfire, it includes planned burning, includes peat fire, and it includes a whole range of industrial fires as well, whether it be fires in the metro area or mine fires. That this framework applies to all of those. The framework sets standards for community health in regard to smoke. It sets standards for the monitoring of those impacts on community, and it also sets standards for the significant or management of significant carbon monoxide events. It also provides tools, so there's a number of joint standard operating procedure and predictive models that have been developed, which are used by incident controllers and agency personnel in the management of these types of events. So it helps inform their decision making, which should lead to better outcomes from a community perspective. It also provides for communication, advice and warnings. So there's been a review of the warnings templates and the advice that's provided to communities in the event of one of these events, and what advice needs to be provided to community in terms of how to minimise the impact. Also provides education, training and behavioural change as well. In addition to that, we have the planned burning decision cycle, and this is something that Forest Fire Management use in terms of minimising impacts or assessing the risks of smoke from a planned burning perspective. This is a continuous cycle, so this is something that we're using all the time throughout the whole program, so right through the planning stages, right through operational delivery, on a daily basis, using this sort of cycle to inform our decision making and look at how we minimise the impact of smoke on community. There's one significant difference to the previous smoke management framework that I outlined. In this one, this is talking about a planned event, so we actually know that we're going to undertake a planned burn on any particular day. So there's things that we can do in terms of managing the risk, given that we know that we're going to introduce fire into the landscape. In the planning phases, we're very much operating in that second quadrant, so the bottom left-hand corner, where we're talking to communities about potential impacts around particularly community events, looking at impacts on critical infrastructure, whether that be power or roads, and also working with industry, primarily wine and apiary industries, to identify what the impacts would be. When we move into the operational space, starting to work very closely with the Bureau, and you'll hear about the smoke model from Beth just in a minute, looking at how that model lets us look at what the smoke loads potentially will be in the atmosphere, where that smoke is likely to travel and where it's going to sit overnight. And we can do that in a predictive sense, and we can also do that in a live sense. So we can look at what burns we've got currently in the landscape, what the fire load is, what the smoke load is, what's going to be the impact if we add more fire to the landscape on those smoke loads. Also working very closely with the EPA across the top there, looking at what monitoring is telling us, so what the current smoke concentration levels are, what the PM2.5 levels are in the smoke, and then also taking feedback from Department of Health and Human Services, so the health sector, whether it be through hospitals, Ambulance Victoria, or through our Victorian Bushfire Information Line. Just quickly, in terms of the planned burning and smoke management challenges, this is a photo from planned burn down at Lawn earlier this year. One of the challenges for us is the source of smoke. The planned burning that we undertake is only one form of smoke generation in the environment on any given day. And for example, in late April, early May this year, there were close to 1,000 burns registered with CFA on private property over a week period. So they're the sort of burns that are not or very difficult for us to capture in a smoke management framework because they're generally operating outside of those frameworks. In addition, we also have drift smoke coming across from New South Wales and from Tasmania from their burning activity. So there's multiple sources of smoke there, not just smoke that's coming from these planned burns that I'm talking about here. The other challenge for us is climate change. We're seeing variability in climate, a drier climate. That's resulting in what we're seeing is longer fire seasons. The window for us to undertake these sorts of planned burning operations is getting narrower. It reduces our flexibility to actually minimise the impact of smoke on the community. And for this year example, we did probably about 60% of our program was delivered in a two-week window in the last week of April and early May. We're seeing changing demographics, so people moving out into the interface. So we're seeing an increase in the peri-urban interface with public land. So people are living much more closely to the forest. Some of those people don't like seeing planned burning. They move there for a particular reason. They don't like to be surrounded by charred or blackened forest. So their view about the benefits of planned burning is certainly can be variable. And community is certainly much more informed these days about smoke impacts through social media. And I think it's fair to say that community tolerance is decreasing for the amount of smoke, and this is going to be one of our greatest issues moving forward, I think. And this is the real challenge for us as land management agencies about how we balance the risk and the risk of smoke against the risk of trying to prevent or minimise the impact of bushfire. What are we doing in the future? So we're working very closely with CFA and our other partner agencies under our Safer Together program. So that brings a 10-year blind approach to treatment of fuel, so across both the public and private interface, and also working a lot more closely with communities in relation to that. That will deal with some of those smoke source issues that I talked about, where we can actually look at incorporating some of the burning activity on private property into the either smoke modelling or the smoke management frameworks. And we're just also looking at bushfire risk reduction programs more broadly now, and looking at how we can quantify from a risk-based approach what the contribution of suppression effort or other preventative measures such as mechanical treatment, strategic road network, or early detection, what their contribution is in terms of a risk outcome for Victoria. So it's not just looking at planned burning as being the only tool to manage risk. And that's me. That's just a little diagram of the smoke model, I think, that Beth will give you a more update on later. Thank you.
Thanks for that. That was fantastic. I'm just going to do a quick transition between PowerPoints. So, so Beth leads the Bureau of Meteorology's Weather and Environmental Prediction Research Section, which conducts research and development in many areas of applied meteorology to improve the Bureau's forecast services. Her personal research interests include diagnostic methods for forecast verification and prediction systems for smoke and air quality, pollen and thunderstorm asthma, and hazard impacts. So welcome, Beth.
Thank you, Kaz, and thank you, Darren, for just about the best segue I've ever had. Thanks for the opportunity to come and talk to you today, and I'll give you a little bit of a description and hopefully a demo, if demos work, you never know with these things, about the smoke and air quality forecasting system that's been developed collaboratively with the CSRO and with DELP. So just by way of background, in the old bushfire CRC, which goes way, way back, there was a smoke prediction system developed then, and it was fairly primitive, but it was better than we had, and it was dispersion of a fixed amount of smoke from a limited number of fixed points in the state of Victoria, and each state around Australia had, you know, a handful of fixed points. And so every day the weather model would be run, and we would put virtual fires in these locations and then watch to see where the smoke went and whether it dispersed a lot or whether it stayed in a plume and was fairly thick, whether stayed close to the ground or you know, went up into the air. It was recognized pretty early on that although that was quite useful, if you could say something more quantitative about the concentrations of the pollutants, and in particular the particulates, that would be a lot more useful for being able to take action on. And so following the Black Saturday, there was a lot more interest in seeing what can we do that's better about smoke prediction. And so DELP funded a fairly large research project led by Martin Cope and the CSRO and involving universities and the Bureau of Meteorology and DELP to take another hard look at the science of smoke combustion from Victorian fuels. So there were field experiments with monitors out there, and Fabian was involved in that. There was the modeling, which is what I can talk about. There were different kinds of other parts of the science about the vegetation itself, how much woody debris was there, where was it to be found. And so the science that came out of that project then went into this smoke modeling system, and it was demonstrated to be useful and skillful, and so the next step was for the Bureau of Meteorology to put that into routine operations so that that DELP would be able to have that that forecast, that knowledge of if they wanted to do a burn, was it going to be a safe time to do it or a safe place to do it? And suppose they did make a decision to do a burn, what would be the concentrations that would result? And if it was going over the standards, well, they might decide, well, let's not do so many burns, or let's move the day, or something like that. So this is quite a collaborative project involving a lot of people, and I have to say it's been really rewarding to be in this multidisciplinary thing, because it was a system that was co-designed by its users, by DELP, and I think that's one of the reasons for its success. So this is another picture. It was similar to the picture Darren showed you, but it's got a whole lot of capabilities marked in there. What I'm going to try and do is demonstrate it, and we'll see whether this works or not. So how do I get to... let's see, I might have to finish off that one. And I want to go to... Is it still there? Okay. So here's today's forecast. I'll put up the PM 2.5. With all the rain that we've had, there's not a lot of burning going on, and there's not very much to look at. But you can see at least what the system looks like. We've got a number of blue dots where we have products here that will help you make a call in the coming week. Are conditions going to be safe in terms of fire weather to do burns? Are they going to be dangerous? Are they going to be wet? No point in doing it. Is the wind going to be in a direction that is problematic? So we have these longer-term forecasts, and these are made from ensemble predictions, which is multiple runs of weather models with slightly varying initial conditions to give us some idea of whether the forecast is very certain or very uncertain. So that's sort of your outlook view. We also have, I'm not going to show you absolutely everything, but we also have vertical profiles of the atmosphere, so the temperature and the dew point temperature. Don't worry too much about the details, but what this will show you is whether there's likely to be inversion conditions, whether it's likely to be good for plume dispersion, or maybe it's going to be very unstable, and if you light a fire, it might blow up and turn into a bad one. So that's the kind of information you can get out of those. Let me just see if I can... I'll zoom in. So let me just... There's not very much activity today. The air quality forecasts, we predict smoke. We show levoglucosan, which is a smoke tracer, PM2.5, PM10, ozone, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and we also now have a PM2.5 rolling 24-hour average, which is a really useful thing for decision-making. If we click on the map, we can get the concentration range, the category, so green is low, and the time and so on. There's mouse over information. There's, if you want to know where the existing fires are, these would be wildfires, and these are planned burns, nothing to look at in Victoria today. A help menu to help you use it. So anyway, that's what I won't be able to show you today is that part of the system is looking ahead at tomorrow and knowing DELP's plans for the burns that they want to do. If we know by, say, mid-afternoon that they're planning to do all these ones tomorrow, we can run it through our model and by an hour later give them back the forecast for all the smoke that would be predicted if they were to do those burns. They can then decide, well, yep, let's go ahead with those or let's cancel a few of those. And then the next day, we know what they've decided to do, and early in the morning, about 5:30 or 6 in the morning, we actually run those smoke forecasts using a smoke prediction model, smoke emission model that's actually attached to a fire model. So it's quite a sophisticated system. And I think at this stage, I'll go back to the presentation if I can figure out how to do it. What do I do? Let's do that. Okay. And here it was. Okay. So that's just some pictures in case the demo didn't well. So let me just back up. So the forecast for the air quality, at the moment they're running 1 day, but it's configured to run 3 days. So when there's the demand, we'll run it for 3 days. What will be the smoke, but also the pollutants. And although I mentioned a limited list, the model is actually capable of doing a lot more pollutants. It's CSIRO's chemical transport model. So if there was sufficient interest, we could make maps for more of the pollutants, make forecasts. This is an example of what the output might look like for one of the planned burns. We do 8 at a time, and we can do up to 64, but that's, you know, just configurable. So this is what the modeling system looks like. Sorry for all the acronyms. This is kind of how it is in the science. But if we start with the upper right, we go from fire information and information on the fuel. And this comes out of the agencies itself and also hotspots. We know something about the fuel amounts. And then we model the actual burning of it. So it takes weather input and the Phoenix Fire Flux model. It's a cut-down version of the fire spread model, generates some smoke which is emitted, and then that goes into the dispersion model, which is also forced by the weather forecasting model. So it's quite an integrated system where weather information and smoke information are used in a few different ways to get the forecast. Just a quick picture of some of the verification against point data that from the EPA monitoring sites. These are showing pretty good correspondence between the forecasts and the observations of PM2.5 at sites. The forecasts are hourly. when we get a big signal, it's easier to verify well. If we don't have much of a signal, this is a different time series from the month of October where there really was very little going on. And so we don't have a big spike, which we've picked up. It's just more, you know, day-to-day variations, a lot to do with urban sources or sea salts and other sources. But just to show that the model's fairly unbiased. So, and I'll just finish up here with where we're going with this. Although it was developed with Victoria in mind, and with, you know, Victoria being the support and the user for it, also the ACT Parks was also a contributor. There is a lot of interest in running this nationally. So particularly among the fire agencies, the AFAC Predictive Services Systems Working Group has got behind this and said, well, instead of states doing their own bespoke or different modeling, let's all work together on one modeling system. So this is where we hope that this will eventually go. We're piloting in New South Wales right now for their use. And yeah, so we're interested in, you know, like I said, going national. If you want to know more about the system, here's a couple of references. The operations bulletin is available on the external web, so you can link to that. And if you're interested in fooling around with it yourself, come and see me, and I can give you a password for the demo site. So thank you.
Thanks for that, Beth. So now we'll be hearing from Liz Hamilton. Liz works as a knowledge broker in the seasonal risk team in Agricultural Victoria. One of the projects she's involved in is the establishment of the Stubble Working Group, an informal group made up of individuals from within and outside government who share a common interest in exploring alternatives to the burning of stubble. So, welcome, Liz.
Thanks.
Hold on.
Just while we're getting going, just to let you know, this is really just focusing on stubble, so there's a lot of other agricultural burning that goes on, as you know, such as heaps and, you know, burning off around farms, and, you know, that can have a significant impact at times. Are these slides going to be made available for everyone, do you think?
I'm not sure.
I was just wondering, because I've put quite a lot of detail... Oh, they will. Great, thank you. I've put quite a lot of detail on my slides because I'm not going to try and read everything, but I just thought, at least if you go back and look at them, they'll make sense. So if you don't take notes, that make it easier. Just to start off, a lot of farmers do aim to retain their stubble. That is what they want to do. And there's actually been some really big projects around how to maintain and manage your stubble profitably through the Grains Research Development Corporation. And it's got well-documented benefits. And it's a big part of conservation tillage. And it's been a big reason why we don't have a lot of those big dust storms that we used to have, because a lot of farmers do retain stubble. I won't show that slide, but you can look at it later, just because it's... I'll talk about it later. But it's a really complex thing. Stubble management, especially in the high-yielding years and in the high rainfall and irrigation zones, there's a lot of stubble. And even with the best equipment, which a lot of farmers are upgrading to now, they can have a lot of trouble in getting their equipment through that stubble. And so in those big years, such as last 2016, it was a big crop year, and so the stubble burning was massive, really, and it was in areas that's not as frequently burnt. So part of the reason, apart from the difficulty in getting their sowing equipment, is pests and diseases that they try to control. And this, you know, the chemical-resistant weed seed is a really big one, because, you know, you go through, you take out all the material, the seed, and then you've got this weed seed that's still there, and burning can be a good way of getting rid of it. But it's usually a last resort. So it is undertaken well and truly on the minority of the total Victorian crop, but in some of the high rainfall zones you'll find it's a lot higher. And just to let you know, we've got a couple of people from AgVic, Daryl Pearl, and also we've got Ray Davies over here from the Pyrenees Show, and they can talk to you more about what goes on in their areas. Daryl's from a low rainfall area, and Ray is from the Pyrenees Shire, where they do a lot of burning. So in that Wimmera sort of area, lower rainfall, that average is somewhere only about 6.1%, but in some of the higher rainfall areas, and I'll show you this next slide from a crop study that a study that they do of farmers. It shows, I haven't got a pointer, but if you can see in there, the higher rainfall parts of Victoria and say Tasmania, for example, you can see that there's that much higher levels of hot burning. So there's two types of burning sort of in the stubble burning area. There's the hot burn where they just burn all the stubble basically en masse, and then there's the cool burning, which is usually taken later, and that's where they will heap a lot of the residue, and it might contain a fair bit of weed seed, into windrows, and they'll just burn them. So again, in these high rainfall zones, I don't have the pointer, but can you see that? Can you see the different parts of Victoria and that up there? That's good. And anyway, just at least we're not as bad as Tasmania. You can look at it that way. So some of the disadvantages, obviously, a lot of smoke, burns that can get away, lots of nutrient loss, something like 80% of the nitrogen within the stubble itself can be lost to the atmosphere, and then, of course, the ongoing erosion from wind and water that can occur. So on the positive side, there's some really good things happening with removed stubble or straw. You know, it's the same thing, really. And that's just an illustration of a type of machinery that can actually go through, take the seed crop off the top, and also cut the stubble underneath and produce bales of straw. Pretty slow and cumbersome, not great for the average farmer who's looking at the weather forecast and saying, well, I've got 3 days to get the crop off. I've got this machinery that's worth this much amount of money. I've got to get in there. But potential opportunity to use that sort of equipment to actually physically remove the stubble rather than burning it. So, again, as I was saying, conservation farming is really important, and we don't want farmers just to think, oh, we should be taking off all the stubble. And the farmers know that they're better off to retain some stubble. So they talk about beer can height or that sort of thing for the ideal sort of height for stubble, and also that 1 to 1.5 tonne per hectare, depending on the zone you're in. So I just want to talk about some of the big things that they do overseas with stubble that we haven't been doing at all in Australia. And again, it's coming back to this bioenergy area. And this is just some examples of projects. And this photo up here is the Avador 2 plant in Denmark. And it's been, I think, 2006, that second plant was installed there. They've got two big boilers, whatever you call them, two big power plants. And this is considered to be one of the most efficient combined heat power plants in the world, 94% efficiency from the energy extracted from the material, and it uses wood and it uses straw. And they've got amazing logistics systems set up, and it's held up as one of those incredibly good examples of what we could be using with stuff instead of burning it on site, putting it through a highly regulated emissions controlled energy system and substituting it from coal. And actually the previous plant there, Avador 1, used to burn coal, and they converted it across to straw and wood after they built that one. Now, this is just another example. Again, in Denmark, they've got 55 district heat and combined power plants in Denmark, which either use just straw or they use straw and wood as a combination. I think, don't quote me, but I've been told that they actually have a mandate to use something like 1 million tonnes of straw per annum. And that's because they don't want them to burn it on site, out in the field. So that sort of policy, of course, has driven this sort of change in the whole way they use material. And even to the extent where they use the ash at the bottom, they distribute it back on the farm, so some of that nutrient at least goes back in. Ray Davis over here, put your hand up and wave, there you go, has been leading this group of 9 landholders to develop alternatives in the Pyrenees Shire. I think they're all a bit fed up with doing a lot of burning. You know, they want to do less of it. So they've been doing a number of studies to look in, first the feasibility for using straw, and then going further and further into that, narrowing it down to what are the best uses of straw. And a couple of the farmers have just come back from Europe and will be reporting through this group as to some of the options that they've seen there for pellet production. They've also been working on some small projects at Skipton Hospital and a larger manufacturing business in the region with the intention of either using pellets or using whole bales of straw for heating and mainly for heating. Because one thing with bioenergy is that if you've got a straight thermal system, it's a lot cheaper and a lot more, a lot less regulation to go through to set up than generating heat and electricity. Another project, and James is here down the back. You might put your hand up. James has been involved in this project. It's not Victoria, obviously, but could have ramifications in terms of potential to supply some of that material that we're using up into New South Wales. And there's also a couple of projects being touted in Victoria, but they're all sort of just in the pipeline. Lots of other uses for straw. There's these 2 minutes. These lovely compressed bales. And is Bryce Riddell here out of interest? No, it's all right. So there's some companies that do heavily compressing of straw because one of the biggest problems is trying to transport a heavy, bulky material like that profitably. There are some very big markets opening up overseas for some of these compressed straw products. Straw bale houses as well, all these other products, which I've only just recently found out about, that are actually made from straw. And when you think about these, some of these uses of straw, the one that I really like at the bottom is, oh, whoops, this one down here. You look at those building materials, and fair enough, all these other ones, they're not reducing greenhouse gas emissions necessarily. They might for short term, but they're all going back and being, you know, getting broken down by microbes and all that sort of thing over a short period of maybe a year or two. So there's not a huge amount of greenhouse gas emission benefits from not burning, because the alternative of putting it back into the soil is it's going to get broken down anyway. But some of these building materials really do lock up that straw long term. And so as well as reducing all the smoke in the burning, you've got a negative emissions product, until the house burns down, that is. This is another really big system that's been going in the UK now for, you know, since 1945, these Stramit compressed straw boards, which are also used in building. I think they had a go at doing that in Dimboola, and it didn't work, but that could have been a marketing problem. I don't know what happened there, but a great product, 100% natural, no resins, anything added to it, and lots of potential. Just so I'm nearly finished. So it's the challenges, big bulky material over a widespread area, the changing supply every year. A year like this, probably not much around because everyone's putting it into stock feed or using it as an absolute last resort, mixed in with other stock and transporting up to New South Wales or wherever. Variable quantity. And we don't have any of these straw to energy plants in Australia. And there's problems. They're difficult. They're more expensive to build. They've got more maintenance issues. But, you know, we're hoping something comes up. Stubble Working Group, I'm heading up. If anyone's interested, come and see me. Daryl and Ray are in that group. And we're just trying to find other solutions to the burning issue. Yeah, more information, give me a hoy. More than happy to have a chat and about anything on that area of bioenergy or to do with rural stubble, that sort of thing. Thanks, everyone. Thanks.
Thanks for that. I definitely learned a lot just then, and I hope that you did too. So we've got about 15 to 20 minutes now to have some questions from the audience, and we'll treat it as a bit of a panel, so we'll try and work out who's best placed to answer your question. So if you have a question, if you could just pop up your hand. Yeah, that's yours. Yep, so we're just... Thanks, Dan.
My question's to Darren. Some of the methods for reducing the biomass, you talked about mechanical as well as planned burns. I'm just interested in what proportion of mechanical removal there is compared to planned burning. And also, obviously, I've got an interest in bioenergy systems, and whether in your view what the potential might be to harvest rather than burn in a planned burn situation and convert that more efficiently into energy solutions as opposed to burning it in situ.
Can you hear me okay? I might just good question. From a fuel treatment point of view, I talked about plant burning as the main source, but also we use mechanical treatments as well. And in terms of mechanical treatment, it's about 10 to 15,000 hectares per year out of a program of nearly 200,000. So it's actually quite a small percentage, so probably well under 10% of the program at this stage. In terms of the effect you get, it's not the same effect in terms of plan burning because it doesn't actually necessarily remove the fuel. It just changes the arrangement. So the fuel is still there, but it does definitely have an impact on fire behaviour by changing that arrangement. In terms of, I know particularly overseas, agencies have looked at removing the biomass, so altogether, and looked at what alternatives that may be for that. I know that Vic Forest have actually tried some trials this year, particularly in East Gippsland, looking at undertaking thinning operations. So they were thinning a piece of silver top regrowth down there and on a commercial basis, and then we were looking at what was the impact in terms of removing that biomass in terms of the fire behaviour, so what was the risk reduction benefit we would get there. But certainly overseas into North America, those agencies are using mechanical complete biomass removal, particularly in and around assets, so in a asset protection zone, so right up against a township or a critical piece of infrastructure, they might use that because it's a fairly costly way of dealing with the fuel. That's about it, I think.
Oh, thank you very much, Anne, for all of our speakers. It's been really interesting hearing, all these three different aspects. And my question sort of touches on all three. It was interesting starting with Darren to hear about the planned burns. A large part of my interest is when we talk about planned burns, they were the fuel reduction burns. Now, I know when we had our major smoke events on the 1st of May, when the smoke haze over Melbourne was the front page of the Sun Herald, 69% of the planned burns were industrial logging burns carried out by Dwelp. Now, that's the burning of our tall, wet forests. And the research shows, especially you're talking about the research from 2009, the 2014 research by Taylor and all describes how our industrial logging processes where we clear fell and then burn the residual, which is 60% of our tall, wet forest, actually adds to the intensity of our fires. So the fact that 69% of our burns at that high pollution area were actually contributing to potential intensity of our fires rather than reducing it was really quite concerning. So I was going to ask, in your discussion, we didn't talk about the majority of the burns at that time and the majority of the volume of the burns, because the fuel reduction burns being lighter, lower burns, the logging burns being very carbon dense burns for smaller areas hasn't been highlighted as part of this discussion. So where the data differentiates between the two is my part of the question. And I really appreciated all Beth's modelling, and I was wondering when that was becoming, if any of that information is to become public for all of us. And the third part for Liz, it was great to see all those alternatives, and I think part of that might be undermined by our native forests being an alternate supply. So because they're supplied quite cheaply, this really good use of stubble is a bit undermined in the market by that. But has there been any proposal to use stubble in paper, for instance, so we don't need to log our forests for the production of paper? Sorry about all of that three-part question. It was also interesting. I couldn't help engage. Thank you very much.
Look, I should have pointed out we undertake burning for a number of reasons. So one is a risk reduction outcome, but we're also burning for ecological purposes as well, so whether that's for flora and fauna, habitat maintenance or enhancement. And we're also got regeneration burning as well, so the coupe burns that you're referring to as part of the burning program. So and that's undertaken to regenerate those forests. It's part of a a cost-effective way, if you like, of regenerating those or replicating what is a natural process and regenerating those forests. So they're part of the planned burning program as well. And all of that burning is managed within the smoke management framework that I talked about today. So in terms of when we think about the risk of smoke and the potential impacts on community, we're also thinking about the coupe burning as being part of that. So, and Beth might talk about that from a modelling sense. In terms of the number, if you look at the individual number of burns on any particular given day, the number of burns can be quite high. But in terms of the area, it's quite a different story. So that the number of hectares that are involved in the coupe burns is a lot less than a broadacre fuel reduction burn. So, and you're right, there is an increase, a short term increase in a risk sense, because you do have a massive fuel load sitting on the ground post timber harvesting. But once that's treated with, it's burnt, that risk is then removed. So that risk is actually quite short term. And when we look at risk management, we're working that across the landscape. So we're looking at right across the landscape. But I accept at a local level, if you look down into individual coops, that there might be a short term increase in the risk.
Thanks, Darren. I guess I'm not going to try and say too much about the smoke from the different kinds of burning, because that's not my particular area of expertise. Martin Cope and Fabian Reisen are good people to talk to for the science on that. But we do recognise that you might get that you would expect to get different concentrations from, the different styles of burning, and also whether it was a very active flaming fire or whether it was smouldering, because the smouldering is more emitting of particles. I will say, just to answer your question about will these products be available to the public, at the moment they're not. It's fairly new science for the Bureau of Meteorology, and so I would say that before releasing it to the public, we would want to get some more experience with it so that we're more sure about its performance and we can really stand behind it. Air quality forecasts, just more generally, currently aren't part of the Bureau's basic product set. It might become in future, but that would have to be a decision for the organization. So at the moment, the driver for this work was really coming from the need to burn safely for the fuel reduction burn. So that's currently its main use and its main interest within the communities that funded this work. However, the modeling capability for air pollution prediction more broadly is something that is a tool that can be used for science and research and sort of science projects or science questions. But providing an actual ongoing service, hopefully that's something for the future. Certainly overseas in the United States or in Europe, there are public smoke forecasts for wildfires. I'm not aware of any ones for prescribed burns, though. So I think the prescribed burns ones tend to be serving agencies that do the burning.
Thank you. That's a good range of questions there. I'll just go to the stubble one about using it for paper. It is used for paper. It's mainly more in developing countries where it's used. I think it's an inferior product, but it's got that potential. But I'm just going to quickly address what you said about that report, just because I used to work as a forester in the Otways 20 years, nearly 30 years ago. And I used to manage all those plantations around the Eyre Valley, really high rainfall, big trees, and there wasn't much of a market for pulp at all. Some went to Laminex. And a lot of those, I don't know about that report, but I suspect that part of that report would have been private land burns as well, and pine plantations as well as Delp, but I might be wrong.
The Chris Taylor
land
in the Wire report is talking about the native forest.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, no worries. Okay. Well, I was just going to say that in terms of the smoke issue, a lot of that is also coming from those private land burns, and a lot of it is because there's not markets for the smaller stuff, like if there's not firewood markets for some of the residue, or there's not pulp markets. And I know that's very controversial. Like, a lot of people don't want to see wood chipping, but I know in the past when they did, when they actually did bring wood chipping back in, they reduced a lot of the material that's in the forest, and the burns weren't as intense. But it's physically really hard to get regeneration or to plant into areas where there's a lot of that slash, so they do tend to get heaped up and burnt. And it's was the one job I hated more than anything, doing that. But it's just, there wasn't many alternatives in steep, wet country, high rate, big trees.
Just a question for Darren. When you're looking at the impact of planned burns, do you take into account just the resident population of areas, or do you also take into account transient tourist traffic? In particular, it tends to be lots of planned burns around Easter time when there's lots of people out in the out there wanting to do bushwalks and all this sort of stuff. And so that's the question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Unfortunately, you know, most of the burning we do is in autumn. That's when atmospheric conditions are stable so that we can safely conduct the burning, both from a firefighter perspective and also from a community perspective. That also means that we tend to line up with some really key holiday periods around Easter and school holidays and things, when Victorians love to get out and enjoy the great outdoors, whether it be bushwalking or down the Great Ocean Road and a whole range of places. So part of our risk assessment is very much focused around the activities of Victorians and where they're going. So we're thinking about that, particularly in the planning, and looking at what the objective of the burns are. And then when we're scheduling burns as well, so we'll, if possible, we'll work, you know, very closely with the Bureau, looking at what the weather conditions are like, and try to the best extent we can to avoid burning in those areas so that we're not impacting on those sorts of recreational activities that people are doing. In terms of messaging, you know, we try to message in through tourism operators in particular at state level, but also very much at a local regional level as well, to try and get the message out there about, you know, if you're a tourist or if you're travelling around Victoria, you know, particularly at that time of year, that, you know, you may come across some of our activities in planned burning and see smoke in particular. So
hi. This question is also for Darren. You talk about cost-effective methods of removal of residual forest material. We heard from Andrea this morning that there's 3,000 excess deaths due to air pollution, mainly particle pollution. And if you take this various estimates of the value of life, it's about $7 million per life. If you multiply that by 3,000, you're talking about $21 billion worth of excess mortality costs across Australia. I don't know what the Victorian proportion is. Have any of those calculations been entered into working out whether something is cost effective?
Thanks. Another good question. I think the short answer is no. You know, and I think, you know, I'm not going to sit here for a second and think that to, you know, what is the cost of a human life? And yeah, so I'm not going to try and justify what we do in the context of that. But no, we haven't done that sort of cost-benefit analysis, not that I'm aware of at least, and certainly in Victoria, maybe that's been looked at elsewhere in other agencies and stuff like that. I think Nat's shaking her head down there, so maybe it has. But, you know, from a departmental point of view, our annual plan burning budget is in the order of about $200 million. So that's roughly what Victorian government contributes to our agency to undertake plan burning and reduce the risk. The plan burning direct costs can vary enormously depending on where you're actually undertaking the burning. So for some of the burning that we do in close to residential areas, you know, that photo I showed you, the back of lawn, that is some of the most expensive burning that we do on a per hectare basis. But when we get into the more remote parts of Victoria, the cost comes down significantly. But in terms of that, the cost-benefit analysis that you're talking about, I'm not aware that we've actually looked at it from that perspective. And I think I touched briefly on it at the end. We are, under reducing bushfire risk, looking at what are alternative means to managing risk in the landscape. And, you know, this year really highlighted it for us, I think, really well, in that in terms of the program, we only delivered probably about 30% of the program due to weather constraints. And so it's not every year that we're going to get presented with a set of conditions that allow us to actually implement the full program and manage the risk through plan burning to the level we'd like. So we are going to have to look at what are alternative measures, whether it be mechanical, whether it's looking at suppression techniques, whether it's looking at our roading infrastructure to allow us to get firefighters into the bush quicker and safer, early detection systems, aviation systems. So we're going to have to take a more broader, holistic look at how we manage risk, because plan burning is not going to be the answer to risk reduction in the future in terms of from a bushfire perspective. And, you know, some of the challenges I talked about from a community point of view in terms of community's tolerance for smoke is getting, that's not even considering the health benefit, the health issues as well. So, we are starting to look at what are those alternative investments that we need to make into the future, and looking at what is the risk contribution of those alternative treatments for us in managing risk at what we think, you know, to try and hit that target of 70% at a statewide level.
My question is about peat fires. It may partly answer some of the questions that have gone to Darren. I lived across the road from a peat fire in 2010, which burnt for several years. I know that across several departments they invested over $1 million in cleaning the roadsides mechanically, because they couldn't burn them because they might catch fire. But really, it wasn't looking after the local residents. It was just because if a north wind picked up fire from there and would go straight through to Esso at Longford, and so they were protecting valuable privately owned assets. However, the questions arising, do we have good mapping of where there are peat areas in Victoria, and are there different things in the smoke coming out of a peat fire compared to what comes from a bushfire or a planned burn?
I think maybe just deal with the smoke issue first. And the smoke from peat fires is different. It's a different combustion process, because it's, peat fire is smouldering under the ground. It's not complete combustion, so it's very much incomplete combustion. So I think carbon monoxide levels are a lot higher in that sort of fire for a start, and probably the PM2 levels are quite a bit higher as well. I know that if I look at a peat smoke fire, smoke from a peat fire, it can be particularly dark and a lot heavier than you would see elsewhere. So I'm just assuming that the PM2 count's probably higher as well. So the smoke's definitely different. What comes off those fires is definitely different. In terms of the mapping, though, we don't have a really good picture of where peat is located across the Victorian landscape. And certainly on the back of the South West fires, the peat fires that we had there earlier this year in March, We're certainly looking at trying to do some of that mapping so that we can identify where those peat areas are, and then we can look at what some of the prevention or preventative measures might be to stop fire from entering those sorts of peat swamps or whatever it might be. So, but we don't at this stage. I think it'd be fair to say we don't have a really good handle in terms of where that risk might sit in the landscape. So.
Hi guys, thanks for your presentation. This is great. So sorry to pick on you, Darren, but there's one more question for you. I was just wondering, how do you engage, say, Indigenous or traditional landowners in regards to perhaps dealing with the scrub in a traditional way, rather than having sort of these spot fires? But the intensity seems to be quite large. And also the amount of smoke. So perhaps burning a little bit less, but smaller amounts and a little bit more often might be a interesting solution to perhaps that. Just wondering.
Yeah, another great question. And this is an area we are doing quite a bit of work, working with traditional owner groups right across Victoria to look at how we bring traditional burning practices back to country. And how we actually, and traditional owner groups are very interested in how we care for country, because and they're looking at return of culture for them. It's really about being able to go back to traditional cultural ways. It's not necessarily about the burning, but the burning is a great opportunity for them to talk more broadly about their culture. So, and. You talk to traditional owner groups, and a lot of the comments you hear back from them is they think the country is unhealthy at the moment, and a lot of that is due to the increase in the fuel loads that we've seen because fire has been excluded from the landscape for a long period of time. And certainly as, Western science, fire science has been very much focused on suppression, and we race out there and we, try to put fires out, and we throw a lot of money and resources at that, and that's probably resulted in landscapes now where we've seen large accumulation of fuel. So traditional owner groups recognise that country's unhealthy as a result of that, and so we are looking at trying to return some of those more traditional cooler burning practices to country through to working with traditional owner groups. Now that there's some risk in that because it we are going to have to deal with some of those high fuel loads that currently exist there. And that can present challenges in terms of doing that burning in an ecologically sensitive way, but also safe to the community as well. But looking at longer term, trying to return to more cooler traditional burning practices where we can. But at this stage, it's it does deliver a risk outcome for us, but it is really more about working with traditional owners about how we're returning culture and caring for country for them.
So, sorry that we have to stop short there. I know that some of you still have further questions, but we'll be breaking for lunch. So will you guys be sticking around, any or all of you? So if you have the opportunity, you might choose to follow up one-on-one. And I'd just like you to join me and thank all of our speakers now.